Radcliffe Brown, of course, was one of the founding influences in what became British social anthropology, especially in Africa. And it's very interesting, and this, I think, in many ways makes the choice of Professor Feeley Harnick particularly appropriate Radcliffe Brown lecturer, because although she's a sort of true American, it's very, very striking how much her work is influenced by Britain. Two of her teachers in New York University were John Middleton and Tom Bivelman, who, although American too, was British trained. But it's also very, very striking in her work. Her first book, The Lord's Supper, is so obviously influenced by the work of Professor Mary Douglas as a central influence. And her massive work on the west coast of Madagascar, A Green Estate, is very much, I think, in the British social anthropological tradition, and even the title, somewhat obscurely I may say, comes from a quotation from Shakespeare. So really, even though she comes from this far-off continent, she's a very clear descendant from the kind of work which Radcliffe Brown started and which continues to flourish. And so I will therefore welcome her and look forward to listening to her, like we all do.
My thanks to the anthropologists of the British Academy for inviting me to give the Radcliffe Brown Lecture in Social Anthropology, and to Peter Brown for having extended the invitation, and to Professor Morris Block for his kind introduction, and to all of you for attending. I'm honored to be here among you. So I'm going to launch right in, because this should be roughly an hour. Let me also say thanks to various archivists, because I won't identify the sources of all my material as they come up, but the Tower Hamlets Local History Library and Archives, the Guildhall Library, the British Library, the Victoria and Albert Museum, Textiles Department, and Kensington Palace. So, the geography of descent. Radcliffe Brown proposed in 1937 to make social anthropology into what he called a natural science of society. His proposal was and remains controversial, especially in the study of kinship and descent with which he's so closely associated. Anthropology originated in part to explain Darwin's descent of man in social terms, raising questions about the social and biological dimensions of human behavior that perplex us to this day. The purpose of this lecture is to use Radcliffe Brown's insights to do an ethnography of science, the science and popular culture of descent, in the fertile decades of the mid-19th century. I will focus on Darwin's work with people outside scholarly circles as then defined, tradesmen and artisans who bred birds and flowers in and about their homes. Silk weavers in London's East End were among the, quote, odd specimens of the human species who fancied pigeons, as Darwin described them to an American colleague. Darwin drew on the breeder's expertise as a model of nature's scrutinizing eye, while rejecting what they called the art of propagating life, which seemed to suggest a grand design. More attention to the silk weaver's art might help to illuminate complexities of descent evident not only in the anthropological study of kinship, but also in the persistence of design-oriented bioengineering, despite Darwin's own emphasis on the randomness of evolution, echoed in Radcliffe Brown's conviction that, quote, a social system is not purposive. So, paradoxes of descent. Radcliffe Brown's Natural Science of Society presents us with a paradox. Anthropology should be modeled after the natural sciences in a search for general laws. Yet anthropology deals with exclusively social phenomena, having nothing to do with biological or any other natural processes. He's most explicit about this in his discussions of kinship and descent, as in this definition from the Introduction to African Systems of Kinship and Marriage, published in 1950. Quote, Two persons who are kin are related in one or other of two ways. Either one is descended from the other, or both are descended from a common ancestor. It is to be remembered that descent here refers to the social relationships of parents and children, not to the physical relation. Radcliffe Brown has been roundly criticized for how he conceived of anthropology as a science and for his laws. 20 years after African Systems, Needham and then Schneider, among others, effectively demolished his definitions in principle and in substance. So why should we still be concerned with intellectual issues laid to rest over 30 years ago? Here are two reasons. First, the paradox of Radcliffe Brown's work remains with us. Social anthropology as the comparative study of human behavior based on the premise that we are all one in Homo sapiens, yet defined in wholly sociocentric terms that make it impossible to achieve the broad intellectual vision of human nature that he hoped for. Persisting concerns about this problem are evident in these very lectures dedicated to Radcliffe Brown. For example, Leach's lecture in 76, Sperber's lecture in 99, each of which makes strikingly different arguments about anthropology as a natural science. And they are evident in anthropologists' latest definitions of descent. For example, Barnard and Spencer's efforts to balance what they call social and actual biological dimensions of descent in their Encyclopedia of Social and Cultural Anthropology, published in 1998. Secondly, contrary to the predictions of anthropologists since the 19th century, including Radcliffe Brown in African Systems in 1950 and Barnard and Spencer in 1998, the significance of descent has not diminished in the face of contractual relations. On the contrary, interest in descent, relatedness based on common ancestry, has grown over the past century and a half. I know from my own research that popular interest in genealogies in the U.S. began in the 1840s, increasing markedly from the 1850s onwards. Genealogical research has become central to contemporary biological research in fields as diverse as genomics, DNA sequencing, systematics, conservation, and the biotechnologies with which they are associated. Genealogical interests among scholars in the life sciences are matched by popular interests in genealogy. The second most visited sites on the internet, after the sexually oriented sites, are the genealogical services and family news groups. It might even be argued that anthropology itself, based in the study of kinship, originated out of this steadily growing, wide-ranging interest in descent. As Rodney Needham said already in 1971, it's this very notion of descent that needs investigation. In particular, the diversity of approaches polarized as they are between biological and social aspects of descent, persisting right up to the present. My argument here is that we need to broaden the framework of our analysis. Simply by restricting our understanding of kinship and descent to humans, we bracket off the larger web of relations in which these debates originated in the 19th century and which they still involve, namely relations among human beings with other organic beings. And we foreclose in advance on the possibility of explanations extending beyond human relations. I propose that we do this by returning to another topic with which Radcliffe Brown is very closely associated, namely totemism. So, totemism in the British Isles. A decade after Darwin argued in Origin that descent is the hidden bond of connection, transforming the plan of creation into a science, his Scots countryman, John Ferguson MacLennan, coined the term totemism to refer to what he saw as the origin of religion. Darwin's influence is evident in MacLennan's use of such terms as breed and species to describe his problem. Yet MacLennan's argument is very different. Totemism involves humans' worship of animals and plants whom they ignorantly imagine to be their kin or breed or species. This is just 10 years after Origin. That is, a religious phenomenon having nothing actually to do with descent. Although MacLennan got much of his data from Lewis Henry Morgan, the American anthropologist, with Ely Parker on Iroquois clan names, totemism, in MacLennan's sense, originated in the British Isles in 1869. So perhaps we should not be surprised that Darwin's ghost continues to haunt the anthropological debate that followed. When Lévi-Strauss sorted things out in totemism today, almost a century later, he credited Radcliffe Brown with pointing the way in his second discussion of totemism in the comparative method in social anthropology. In this lecture, interestingly enough, it was given as the Thomas Huxley Memorial Lecture for 1951, Radcliffe Brown questioned why people should identify their social groups by association with particular natural species, as he put it. Quote, "At this point, we may feel inclined to ask why these social divisions should be identified by reference to two species of birds. Why all these birds? It is, however, not always a question of birds. Moieties may also be associated with other pairs of animals. Why particularly eagle hawk and crow and other pairs? Thus, as Lévi-Strauss saw it, Radcliffe Brown's contribution was to argue that, quote, their perceptible reality permits the embodiment of ideas and relations conceived by speculative thought on the basis of empirical observations. Though Lévi-Strauss summarized Radcliffe Brown's position and his own as good to think, this is not actually the purely intellectualist view usually ascribed to Lévi-Strauss, but an effort to integrate domains. Scholars like Descola, Ingold, Peterson, Viveros de Castro have taken this still further by re-examining our conceptions of animism and totemism, to which Viveros de Castro would add perspectivism. This work has been most fruitful in suggesting that we should follow Halliwell in his studies of the Ojibwa in examining bonds of sociality across species. Yet we must be wary of reifying by contrast what Viveros de Castro describes as a Western naturalist ontology in which the nature-society interface is natural. In fact, Darwin's naturalism doesn't conform to the biological reductionism that's currently being critiqued. His views, especially expressed in his notebooks, especially those expressed in his notebooks, might more accurately be described as animist in Ingold's terms. The formation of an increasingly narrow naturalism seems to be an historical phenomenon, developing out of shifting political, economic, and ecological relations between people, animals, plants, and land, increasingly intensified in the British Isles and in North America from the 1830s onwards, and elaborated in new forms in European colonies abroad. So our comparative perspective might better be served by a more historical perspective, analyzing the phenomenon in an analytical framework that does not presuppose the very naturalism it seeks to investigate in order to understand how and why that naturalism might have emerged. As it happens, Darwin put birds, pigeons, at the very heart of his cosmic vision of transmutation and extinction that he presented in Origin of Species. So let us now follow Radcliffe Brown's suggestion and ask, as he did, why all these birds? And furthermore, to paraphrase him slightly, why particularly fancy pigeons in all their varieties? How might they be related to eagle hawk and crow and evident interest to people elsewhere? And what light might the relations between the humans and the birds shed upon the entangled bank, filled, as Darwin said, with singing, flitting, and crawling creatures, where he sought the hidden bond of descent? Pigeons, if you please. Darwin's Origin of Species begins with these words, quote, "When on board HMS Beagle as naturalist, I was much struck with certain facts in the distribution of the inhabitants of South America and in the geological relations of the present to the past inhabitants of that continent." Darwin certainly used the many facts he recorded in his 5 years on the Beagle in supporting his argument that biogeography of the finches in the Galapagos proved to be critical. These are from Darwin's Journal of Researches in 1845. Yet he was also quick to credit the insights he gained from his work with animal breeders, whom, as he said, most other naturalists had ignored. His notebooks and correspondence shows that animal and plant breeders, livestock men, gardeners, horticulturalists, poultrymen, but especially pigeon breeders in Britain and beyond, informed him in the ways of picking or selecting that they called artificial selection, which Darwin then used as his model for natural selection. Perhaps the most succinct way of summarizing the magnitude of the pigeons in Origin of Species is this. When Darwin sent his manuscript to publisher John Murray, Murray asked for an evaluation from Whitwell Elwin, the rector of Booton in Norwich, his close associate who had edited the Quarterly Review. Elwin wrote back to Murray saying that he and Sir Charles Lyell agreed that Mr. Darwin should publish the part on the pigeons and leave the rest for later. As Elwin put it, quote, "Everybody is interested in pigeons. The book would be reviewed in every journal in the kingdom and would soon be on every table. I'm certain its reception would be the best stimulus to the prosecution of his subsequent work." Elwin's argument now seems hard to understand, perhaps even ludicrous. Yet Darwin's persistence in linking these two phenomena also raises questions. Why should pigeon breeding have been so central to his argument about natural selection? And why should a book on pigeons have been so welcome in every journal in the kingdom and every table? We can begin to understand this better when we know two things. First, the pigeons in Origin are just the tip of the iceberg in Darwin's own work. And second, the fowl mania, as it was called in the popular press, for fowls, birds, ranging from pigeons to poultry to wild birds from Britain and all over the world, was broadly shared across classes during the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, exactly when Darwin was researching and writing on transmutation. So let us take each of these in turn. Darwin's early interest in domestication is evident in the notebooks he kept from 1836 to 44, in his early essays of 42 and 44, which begin with the same analogy, and in his correspondence. In the spring of 1855, 20 years after returning from his beagle voyage, Darwin followed the advice of William Yarrell, a newsagent in the area of St. James Square, and a self-trained naturalist, who suggested that if Darwin was interested in transmutation, he should focus on pigeons. Yarrell had recently completed a three-volume History of British Birds, published in 1843, in which he argued that Britain's fancy, among other things, that Britain's fancy pigeons, which many breeders regarded as a distinct species, all of them, distinct species created by God, had a common origin in the rock dove, Columba livia. And this is the beautiful picture from Yarrell's History of British Birds of the rock dove, which flies throughout the coast of the British Isles. Darwin started buying pigeons from John Bailey, a well-known bird seller in the West End, not far from Yarrell's home and shop. By early November of 1855, Darwin was encouraging Sir Charles and Lady Lyell to visit by promising that, quote, "I will show you my pigeons, which is the greatest treat, in my opinion, which can be offered to a human being," unquote. A few days later, he was writing to J.D. Hooker that he had, quote, "pairs of 9 very distinct varieties, and I love them to the extent that I cannot bear to kill and skeletonize them," unquote. By late fall of 1855, he'd been elected as a member to 2 London pigeon clubs, the Philopteridion, which means lovers of the dovecote in Greek, and the Columbarium, dovecote in Latin, in Southwark. By May 1856, the pigeons had become so central to his questions about natural selection that Lyell wrote to him saying, "I wish you would publish some small fragment of your data on pigeons, if you please, and so out with the theory and let it take date and be understood." As Darwin eventually explained to the readers of Origin, he used the pigeons and their human breeders to introduce his ideas about nature because humans' domestication of plants and animals provides the best, quote, "explanation for the co-adaptations of organic beings to each other and to their physical conditions of life, the best and safest clue." The pigeons remained primary in his subsequent works on domestication. even compared to what Keith Thomas called such privileged species in Britain as horses and dogs. Pigeons occupy over 100 pages in Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication. That was published about 10 years after Origin in 1868, compared to about 30 pages each on dogs and cats, 17 on horses and asses, 15 each on pigs and cattle, 8 on sheep, 3 on bees, and 1 on goats. Darwin's Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex, published in 1871, 3 years later, is essentially an analysis of the descent or origin of man as a process of domestication, drawing on comparisons of savage and civilized people with wild and domesticated animals, already outlined in his Journal of Researches, published in 1839. So why pigeons? Darwin's analogy between artificial and natural selection. Historian Robert Young has argued that the breeders' ways of picking or selecting that they called artificial selection gave Darwin his key metaphor for explaining what he called natural selection. Historian James Secord argues further that Darwin used his first-hand observations of the breeders' fine distinctions of the pigeons' smallest variations, especially evident in competitive shows, as a model of nature's scrutinizing eye. As Darwin described it, nature acting during long stages and rigidly scrutinizing the whole constitution, structure, and habits of each creature. This is an image from the Illustrated London News showing the Philoperisteron show in 1851. And from left to right, Jacobin carrier, Jacobin powder, almond tumbler, and yellow models. This is a silver dun Antwerp showing in those little alphabetic letters all the areas of the head alone, which you would be very careful to measure. And you carried special slide rules with measuring up to 1/16 of an inch to do that measuring. This is a head molder just to illustrate the sort of thing you shouldn't be doing, because you're meant to breed these differences out of the reproduction of the bird and not force them on them by such things as head molders. At Thomas Huxley's suggestion, Darwin included in Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication engravings of the birds to give the reader a sense of the education not found in books that he got directly from the breeders. These images, drawn from life, from left to right here, an English owl, English carrier, English powder, English almond tumbler, and English fantail, drawn from life, are to be compared with the wild rock pigeon, Columba livia, the parent form of all domesticated pigeons, as Darwin said, represented by the dead bird hanging upside down over there. As Darwin notes, the diversity of breeds is something astonishing. Darwin attributed the capacity to originate such diversity from a common ancestor to the breeders' acute observation of the minutest variations in the forms of their fancies, their shape, their carriage, the head, the beak, the eye, the feathers, the colors. A learned skill requiring, as he said, a lifetime of indomitable perseverance. For biologist Mary Bartley, Darwin's pigeon breeding was not simply a metaphor or analogy. More than any of his other experiments, pigeon breeding provided him with the data on inheritance and growth for his theory of generation called pangenesis, outlined at the end of Variation, and abstracted in the form of this genealogy of descent. Who are the pigeons in these relations? Darwin claims they are, quote, mere stones or bricks without the builder's art. He acknowledged that famous breeders, like Youatt, spoke of the principle of selection as, quote, the magician's wand by means of which he may summon into life whatever form and mold he pleases, unquote. Yet to make his argument that variations are due to unknown causes and without purpose, Darwin has to downplay the very artisanry that he admires, describing the breeder's work in Origin as a kind of selection which may be called unconscious, lest he imply that nature is governed by a grand design. I argue that to make his case for the random impersonality of natural selection, Darwin also had to play down the sociality, even spirituality, involved in the breeders' relations with their birds, based as much in the home as in the workplace. So let us turn now to the breeders. Little men. The London pigeon breeders whom Darwin got to know best were in the trades, especially trades related to journalism. Yarrell and Bolt were both news agents. Tegetmeyer was a journalist and an editor. Harrison Weir was an illustrator and a painter. John Eaton was a tailor in Southwark. This is a portrait of the members of the Savage Club, a club for men in the commercial arts to which Tegetmeyer belonged, showing the members dressed like Indians, in feathers, and in Tegetmeyer's case, dressed in a powder pigeon. He's somewhere about halfway up on the right. Their businesses were in the West End and in Southwark, their clubs in pubs in the areas of Covent Garden and Lincoln's Inn Field, Berkeley Square, the Borough. But they themselves, in exactly these years in the mid-1850s, when Darwin knew them, were moving out to the suburbs north and south of London, roughly a generation after Darwin himself had moved his new family from Upper Gower Street to Down in 1842. Darwin respected them for their knowledge, yet he described them as little men in a letter to his son William in November of 1855. Quote, I want to attend a meeting of the Columbarium Society, which meets at 7 o'clock near London Bridge. I think I shall belong to this society, where I fancy I shall meet a strange set of odd men. Mr. Brent was a very queer little fish. After dinner, he handed me a clay pipe, saying, here's your pipe, as if it were a matter of course that I should smoke. Another odd little man, nota bene, all pigeon fanciers are little men, I begin to think. And he showed me a wretched little Polish hen, which he said he would not sell for £50, and he hoped to make £200 by her, as she had a black topknot. We are able to get to know these men a little through Darwin's correspondence and through the London post office directories of the time. We know them mainly through their birds, their writings about pigeons and pigeon breeding, and their drawings and paintings. Portraits, in some cases, give some indication of what Darwin left out of his account, especially concerning the association of pigeon breeding, domestic relations, and their own homes and yards. This is the frontispiece to Eaton, the tailor in Southwark, his treatise on the art of breeding and managing fancy pigeons, a portrait from life of a bird in his possession, done, painted, and engraved by Dean Wolstenholme. And it's too bad you can't see it in color. Pigeons were celebrated, first of all, for their loyalty and devotion. They were monogamous, to use the breeder's own language, expressing their love for each other in the Columbine kiss and forming lifelong unions. The male and female birds together brooded their eggs and nursed their young with a substance called pigeon's milk, which, in being regurgitated from their crops, seemed to come from their very breasts. The pigeons' loyalty to their mates allowed a breeder to keep many pairs of many kinds in the same loft without worrying that they would interbreed. Their social bonds were thought to explain the pigeons' famous homing ability, which extended to their human breeders, in whose hands they would allow themselves to be held, which is said to be one of the great charms of the pigeon fancy. This comes from Wright's book, published in 1882, actually in several editions. This is the fourth edition in 1882. Secondly, the pigeons seem to have been regarded as children, especially the breeder himself as a child. Breeders' favorite pigeons are typically the kinds they kept as children, remembered together with the parent or family friend who gave them their first birds, and almost always with a close childhood friend. The birds evoke a larger world of intimate relations, including humans as well as animals. While Darwin abstracts the fancier's designs and social relations from his analysis of the historical origins of the various breeds of fancy pigeons, the fanciers connect them, representing the birds' genealogical histories as human genealogies as well. Thirdly, they were associated with ideals of craftsmanship. While Darwin has to downplay the breeder's artistry, this is the breeder's main interest. The art in pigeon breeding lay not simply in the beauty of the birds, but also in the delicacy of the relations through which they agreed to make their home with the breeder, be fruitful and multiply. In the words of Reverend Lucas, writing his memoirs as a pigeon fancier in 1886, quote, "Pigeon fancying is the art of propagating life. The production of living pictures, beautiful in form and rich in color, the fancier is an artist, and no artist has attained to perfection in the art. The best bird has yet to be bred." These ideals of craft and art may well have differed in different trades. Racing pigeons have long been a favorite of miners in the north of England, though this actually seems to be a later development. In the case of fancy pigeons in Britain, the trade was textiles. Darwin himself made the connection in order to comment on the seeming arbitrariness of aesthetic tastes in the fancy, so that breeds highly valued in one place might be worthless in another. Quote, "Fashions in pigeon breeding endure for long periods. We cannot change the structure of a bird as quickly as we can the fashion of our dress." Unquote. The enormous importance of these craft ideals among textile workers may be better appreciated if we go even deeper into the heartland of the pigeon fancy, which, as everyone knew then, lay not with the middling classes of news agents, journalists, and the better sorts of tailors, but with people formerly called artisans, but then increasingly mechanics or operatives, and not in the West End of London, but in the East End. As Reverend Lucas also explained, considering the pedigree in England, Spitalfields is the cradle of the fancy. So, Spitalfield weavers. In September of 1856, Darwin wrote to an American colleague, James Dwight Dana, a geologist and zoologist at Yale. "In the case of pigeons, we have, and in no other case, we have much old literature, and the changes in the varieties can be traced. I have now a grand collection of living and dead pigeons, and I am hand in glove with all sorts of fanciers, Spitalfield weavers, and all sorts of odd specimens of the human species who fancy pigeons." Darwin would have learned about the fanciers of Spitalfields through the men he'd met through Yarrow. The origins of the fancy among artisans and mechanics comes out clearly in their accounts. For example, the same Mr. Brent, whom Darwin found to be a very queer little fish, in 1855, had written a couple of years earlier, in 53, quote, "Time was, and not many years since, when a pigeon fancier was associated in all men's minds with costermongers, pugilists, rat catchers, and dog stealers, and for no other reason than we can discern than that the majority of pigeon fanciers were artisans, men who lived in the courts, alleys, and other byways of the metropolis. Excepting the shop of John Bailey in Mount Street, Berkeley Square, most of the London bird markets were located in the poorest neighborhoods. Of these, the best known was the Club Row Market in the East End, behind Shoreditch Church, in Club Row and Sclater Streets, extending over to Brick Lane, in the area then broadly known as Spitalfields. The Club Row Market remained the most important bird market in London up to 1983, when the RSPCA finally succeeded in banning the street sale of live animals after decades of protest. This here is an image from the graphic published in 1869 of the bird market, also showing a sailor because many of the birds came in off the docks, the London docks. This is a photograph that was taken by Malby in 1904, showing men looking at bird cages in Sclater Street, Bethnal Green. And this is a photograph from 1915 of the bird market in Sclater Street, which every Sunday morning filled the street to brimming, as you see. So who were the Spitalfields weavers, and why were they such odd specimens of the human species that they would fancy pigeons? Besides the accounts of contemporary writers like Mayhew, London city missionaries, medical inspectors, and various others, the most detailed evidence comes from parliamentary papers, especially the reports on the conditions of the handloom weavers, written from 1838 to 41 during the very years when Darwin was writing his notebooks on transmutation and metaphysical inquiries. Spitalfields was a place just outside the old east wall of the city, long identified with the manufacture of silk by handloom weavers in families, in row houses with tiny yards, doing work so exacting that it required what was then called a weaver's eye. During the years that Darwin was writing his notebooks, that's 1836 to 44, and eventually Origin of Species in 59, they had become the very emblem of the most intense debates in political economy over the persistence of handloom weaving in the face of the rapid industrialization of the textile trade, the value of international free trade in promoting domestic wealth, whether the Spitalfield weavers could compete with other districts without the protections of the Spitalfields Acts repealed in the mid-1820s. In short, what one of the parliamentary reporters called in 1840, the great mystery of human progress. Drawing on the reports of these contemporary observers of the Spitalfields weavers in the process of their transmutations in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, that eventually resulted in what became known among the weavers as the Black Decades of the 60s through the 90s, I will make four points. First, concerning the ecology of silk as a fancy article, its relations to land and to seasonality. Secondly, concerning housing. Third, the nature of the work which required a weaver's eye. And four, its familial mode of descent. So, the ecology of silk as a fancy article. Legal and other documents from the 1330s to the 1600s testify to the presence of the trade art or mystery of silk working in the fields east of London beginning in the 1330s. The historical transmutation of the silk manufacture gradually spreading out to what became the parishes of Christchurch, Spitalfield, and Bethnal Green, the hamlet of Mile End Newtown, with portions of Whitechapel, Hackney, and St. Leonard's Shoreditch, is inextricable from the transmutation of land use patterns in East London. This process can be seen in maps from the mid-1700s through the mid-1800s. And this is Rolfe's map of London from 1746. And this is the survey map of London that was done from 1861 to 68. That is roughly around the time of Darwin's origin. Owing to the delicacy of silk fibers, mechanization of silk proved difficult to do without breakage. Therefore, handloom weaving persisted much longer in the manufacture of silk compared to cotton, wool, and linen, and in all three branches of the trade, plain, figured, and fancy. Fancy being the technical term for the highest class of figured goods, including velvets, cloths of gold, and the like. It being a fancy article, to cite the testimony of a silk manufacturer to the House of Lords in 1823, quote, "The capital, like a nursery ground, rears the articles and propagates the manufacture to all parts of the kingdom." As a fancy article, the silk manufacture was at once highly lucrative, yet highly seasonal, and despite these intermittent protective tariffs, its growth was utterly unpredictable, subject, as stated in the parliamentary reports, to caprices of fashion that baffle all calculation. Thus, weaving in the fields east of London was associated with the development of market gardening, as well as seasonal labor at the London docks. Secondly, housing. The transmutation of the silk manufacture in relation to land is most evident in houses because, as one of the parliamentary reporters pointed out, a weaver needs a house to put his loom in, unlike shoemakers and tailors who don't need that kind of space. Silk manufacture in the reigns of Queen Anne and King George, that is roughly 1702 to 27, was still based in house workshop rooms in the parish of Christchurch, Spitalfield, connected to patches of garden land and garden houses out in the hamlet of Bethnal Green and beyond. As the silk manufacture spread out into neighboring parishes, especially into Bethnal Green, the houses gave way to densely, these larger houses, gave way to densely packed rows of houses with tiny yards that were even more critical in supplementing income, as some of the more easily mechanized aspects of the silk manufacture moved out of London, driving prices down in Spitalfields. Thus, the small domestic animals and plants sold in street markets must also be seen as the outcome of a kind of radical intensification of the historical process of enclosure, although not officially the outcome of the Enclosure Acts, resulting in a kind of abstracting and shrinking. What one observer in 1841 called from the perspective of a rider on the newly built Eastern Counties Railway heading out from Shoreditch into Essex, a philosophy of the roofs of houses, expressed in the weavers' windows and dovecotes at the top of their houses. This is an image from the Illustrated London News showing the weavers' houses in these houses that were built during the early 1700s, showing the weavers' windows, those latticed windows at the top, called lights, because that was their purpose, and the dovecote on the roof. This is a picture of Cranbrook Street. This was taken in 1933, looking east toward the Alma Wharf on Regent's Canal out in Bethnal Green, Globetown, actually, showing you an example of the weaver's lights in smaller houses that began to be built from 1851 onwards. This is Pettit's Walk. This is a photograph from 1870, Pettit's Walk, which is now Finnish Street in Bethnal Green, showing the Waterlow buildings in Wilmot Street, constructed by the Improved Industrial Dwellings Company in 1869. That is, the kind of gardens that were gradually being constructed out of existence. And this is Pereira Street, a photograph from 1900, looking south. This area was cleared shortly after World War I, that is about 20 years after the London County Council took this photograph. And you can see in the backyard, but probably not so well, backyards, a birdcage on the back of this privy, another birdcage there at the kitchen door, and then this structure way down here, which is a dovecote. Thirdly, the birds and plants alike were linked to artisanal ideals. They were an aesthetic expression of ideals of craftsmanship associated with silk weaving, especially skills in the design and execution of the forms, textures, and patterns of fancy and figured goods like velvets, damasks, and patterned textiles, in which the weaver's eye was critical to the quality of the work. So when Thomas Huxley, in his Lectures for Working Men in 1863, introduced Darwin's theory using Darwin's example of pigeon breeding, emphasizing to these working men his ignorance of what he called the great art and mystery of pigeon fancy, he might have used the guild language of their crafts as a joke, but he was also expressing the connection between their craft and their fancy. Thus, the scrutinizing eye of the pigeon fanciers, so apparent in the handling of their birds, has its corollary, or perhaps its prototype, or more likely, its interactive counterpart in the scrutinizing eye required in the most skilled work, the fancy articles of their craft. The extraordinary craft expressed in the weaver's eye can best be appreciated from a closer look at the cloth itself. For example, the coronation velvets that George Doré, a velvet weaver and warp spreader, wove for the coronation of Edward VII and the enthronization of Queen Alexandra that was held on the 26th of June in 1902. Frank Warner, a silk manufacturer, interviewed Doré in his home in Alma Road in 1914, just a couple of years before Doré died. This is his account of Doré's house and yard, then occupied by Doré himself and another family, the family of one of his married children, all of which was torn down in 1959 to build Cranbrook Estates, now in Globetown. Quote, "The house contains four rooms on the ground floor, and a passage from front to back divides it in the center. As one enters this passage, there can be seen through the open door at the opposite end of it a small backyard gay with flowers in bloom and furnished with a large, neat aviary in which a few specimens of a delicate prize breed of pigeons coo and strut in the summer sunshine in all the pride of their penciled iridescent plumage." The entire upper floor of Doré's house, reached through a trapdoor so as not to waste space, was occupied by Doré's warp spreading equipment, the machinery and looms used by other family members. So the upper floor, being completely filled by this warp spreading and weaving equipment, Doré wove the coronation velvets in his parlor. This is King Edward VII at the taking of the oath before the Archbishop of Canterbury in Westminster Abbey from a painting by S. Begg, as reproduced in the Illustrated London News of 1902, giving you a sense of a bit of the coronation velvet stretching out behind, said to take 8 pages to hold it, lined with ermine and covered with an ermine cloak. According to what George Doré, the weaver, told William Mankey, who interviewed him for the Huguenot Society in 1912, King Edward's coronation velvet was 30 yards long, 20 inches wide. Queen Alexandra's was 12 yards long. To use the technical expressions of the trade, it was a 1,850 thread, 60 wire, 180 shoots, and treble pole with a 2-thread ground. It took 6 yards of the top cane, that is the top warp, to make 1 yard of the pile of velvet. This means that Mr. Doré had to weave in the brass reed 60 times to every inch. To each square inch, 33,120 threads stand on end, roughly 763 million of these threads in the entire piece, so perfect in match and size that they were strong enough that a man could stand on the velvet without pressing it down. Finally, the familial mode of generational descent. This skill work is transmitted through families. The descent of families is inextricable from the descent of their craft in their particular working conditions. The taprooms of pubs and beer shops seem to have been the places where men carried out their transactions with other men, including their trade in birds. But the reproduction of the craft, like the breeding of their birds, was clearly familial. Based in their own homework shop yards, involving spouses, transmitted from parents to children, a point that comes up repeatedly in the testimonies of weavers and manufacturers in the parliamentary reports. Thus Mitchell, one of these reporters, asks in 1840, what are the chief sources of the numbers that come into the trade? The weavers bring up their families to be weavers from a desire to get something from their labor as soon as possible. He cites the testimony of weaver John Deuce. Too great attachment to the occupation is the bane of the trade. There is a sort of independence about the work in terms of hours. The weaver also, this is John Deuce still, the weaver also enjoys the society of his family. He feels strongly the domestic attachments, even beyond what cool reason would approve. From all these causes, it is that many are drawn into the trade and afterwards bring up their children to it and cling to the trade under every disadvantage, unquote. The work could be transmitted through the inheritance of objects, like the loom itself, also pattern books and other tools of the trade. But it was also understood by participants and observers alike to be transmitted through the body in at least 2 respects. First, in the passing on of skills beginning in childhood, expressed as bringing up their children to it. Second, the descent of the trade was understood by contemporaries to be evident in the progressively smaller size of the weavers in every generation. The silk weavers of Spitalfields were widely known as little men because of the very practice of their craft over generations. So from Mitchell's report of 1840, quote, that the weavers of Spitalfields are of a small stature has long been matter of public notoriety. Many of the witnesses examined have stated that they were the sons and grandsons of weavers and that their wives were the daughters and granddaughters of weavers. Such men form a caste and are of small size. Mitchell quotes the observation of a weaver, Mr. Redfarn, to which others agreed, quote, they are decayed in their bodies. The whole race of them is rapidly descending to the size of Lilliputians. Finally, I would argue that these ideas and practices of the hereditary craft of silk weaving, embedded so deeply in the constitution of weavers that they passed into the very bodies of their children and grandchildren, were expressed in their birds. The pigeons also involved a kind of bringing up or shaping of children, using exactly the same kinds of skills and ideals of the silk weaver's craft, in which the shaping of children who were to be the next generation of workers was essential to the life of a family as well as the reproduction of the trade. As among the middling classes of breeders, the pigeon fancy in Spitalfields seems to have been a lifelong pursuit passed on from fathers to sons. And perhaps, as with Tegetmeyer, Lucas, and others, the birds had special associations with the childhood of the fancier himself as a boy when he got the birds who became his lifelong favorites. These generational relations are likely to have been especially significant given the importance in the fancy branch of the living draw boy, that is ideally a son or a nephew rather than some boy you hired off the street, by comparison to the mechanical draw boy then being introduced in the mechanization of silkwork. As Warner, the silk manufacturer, put it, he, having moved his silk manufacture that he inherited from his grandfather and father from Spitalfields to Braintree in 1895, in a few years at most, the silk weaving industry in London will be extinct for lack of weavers, leaving nothing quite like the methods and traditional arrangements of Spitalfields to be found elsewhere. And indeed, that has happened. So let us return now to Radcliffe Brown's question about totemism. How might these fancy pigeons be related to eagle, hawk, and crow, and other pairs of such interest to people elsewhere? And what light might the relations between the humans and the birds shed upon the entangled bank where Darwin sought the hidden bond of descent? So the last section, from Egypt direct to Birmingham, an avian perspective on biogeographical change. The weaver's birds and flowers exemplify ideals specific to the silk industry, but also much more broadly shared among British artisans in the textile trades because of shared ideals about craftsmanship, especially in fancy or figured work, because of shared experiences of the political ecological circumstances involved in urbanization, but possibly also because of shared experiences of the fragility of their familial lives during these years of rapid industrialization, in which the hereditary transmission of the trade from parents to children was ever harder to achieve, and even the possibility of keeping their children under one roof was difficult. As Hickson put it in the summary of the parliamentary reports on the conditions of handloom weavers in 1840, America is regarded by many of our artisans as their second home. The number of people living in cities in England and Wales increased from 34% to 54% of the population in the years between 1801 and 1851, and continued rising steeply thereafter. These changes were expressed in what might be described as an avian imagery of biogeographical change, evident in contemporary slang, especially slang having to do with migration and resettlement, especially of poor people, the rookeries where they congregated, the slop housing known as bird cages constructed there, the birds of prey, to use Dickens' language in Our Mutual Friend, that hovered round them. In ways we can't discuss here, British birds, as Yarrell called them in 1843, also seem to have become salient markers of ecological change for everybody concerned. The fancy pigeons' origins, as breeders in Britain then understood them, lay in the ancient Near and Far East, Turkey, Palestine, Egypt, Arabia, Persia, India, China, from which they were now being imported. These are Oriental rollers depicted on the Oriental buildings of their origins. So the famous fancier Robert Fulton described the magnitude of the international trade in fancy pigeons in the mid-1870s in Birmingham, Britain's second largest manufacturing center after London, from Egypt direct to Birmingham. So we might also say, from the Galapagos direct to the British Isles. Darwin makes it clear in his own writing, in Origin and in Variation, that the pigeons of England stand for the finches of the Galapagos, just as he used the microcosmic world of the pigeon breeders to stand for the immensity of the face of nature. Darwin's analogy works in more than one direction. His work in the Galapagos affected the way he saw and interpreted the radically changing political ecology of the British Isles, the shift from agriculture to industrialization, associated with massive migrations from countryside into cities, especially London. Secord has argued that, quote, the history of natural history needs to become part of environmental history, unquote. We would do well to put the study of kinship back into the context of the political economy of land and labor, the geography of descent, in which it was so crucially embedded. Darwin's argument about natural selection and origin of species is increasingly biogeographical and ecological. His argument ends in the entangled bank, clothed, as he says, with many creatures of many kinds, elaborately constructed forms so different from each other and dependent on each other in so complex a manner, unquote. To me, the most fruitful form of Darwinism comes from Darwin, the soil scientist, whose life works are framed chronologically at the beginning and end by interests in corals and worms, which he saw as the temperate counterpart to corals. These are creatures whose organic beings are inseparable from the inorganic relations of which they are part. Yet Darwin's argument about artificial selection is strikingly abstracting. Artificial selection is to be found in the eyes, but especially the hands of breeders, abstracted from context. Indeed, the larger immediate context of interest in domestication, at least since the development of the Wardian case in the late 1830s and early 40s, exactly those years of Darwin's notebooks and the parliamentary reports, is to take plants from one place and domesticate them or naturalize them in another. Yet what happens when the organisms do not move from one land to another, but from land to hand, including the invisible hand of the market that Smith imagined would transform private gain into public good? Darwin seems to have come upon the pigeons as a means of understanding life processes precisely because they served this purpose for people more broadly, a means of apprehending the immensities of the face of nature, including the vagaries of silt, backyards, and rooftops. In Spitalfields, and I think more broadly, the birds were intimately linked to processes of manufacturing in the textile trades, in which design had a far more specific sense than the grand design of creation might suggest. That is, fashions in consumption, which increasingly dictated the rhythms of the labor process. For the silk weavers of Spitalfields, pigeon breeding, the kind of fancy pigeons like the pouters for which the Spitalfield weavers were famous among pigeon breeders, was a kind of hand loom weaving in the very materials of their lives. As Secord has pointed out, many historians have examined Darwin's extensive reading in political economy while overlooking or taking for granted his relations with the pigeon breeders. Now, from our current vantage point, the breeders appear far more significant in the long run, even while Darwin's own reputation has waxed and waned and then waxed again. The most consistent outcome of our social and biological interest in transmutation has been our ever greater capacity to breed animals and plants according to our designs and transfer this knowledge to the breeding of human beings and now the body parts of animals as well. Yet I think these processes by which the birds move from the bushes to the hand, from the fields to the rooftops, suggest that we also need to examine the ways in which the hidden bond of descent, abstracted in genealogical terms, may link all forms of life more tightly, yet more unequally, through historical processes of disconnection from land, expressed in migration and dispossession. Keeping in mind the weaver's perspectives on these processes, I found myself wanting to know more about the Brown family in Birmingham, into which Radcliffe Brown descended in 1881. As John Middleton has observed, this kind of information about early life, including childhood, is relevant to later intellectual life. Radcliffe Brown, whose father died young as a result of his work as a commercial traveler for a Birmingham manufacturer, he became a kind of labor migrant himself, working most of his life outside the British Isles, in the Andaman Islands, northwestern Australia, Tonga, Cape Town, Sydney, Chicago, Yenching, Sao Paulo, Alexandria, and Grahamstown, where many of his colleagues would also have been labor migrants. And doing his ethnographic research with people, perhaps most notably in Australia, who were themselves migrants in far more forcible terms, the radically abstracted forms in which he worked was undoubtedly compounded by the massive dislocations and migrations of the people on whom he worked. Abstractions not only from places, but also from the people in those places, competing labor regimes. And perhaps these circumstances were normalized by an ideology of kinship to contract, clearly evident in Radcliffe Brown's own preface to African Systems, in which he argued that, quote, comprehensive obligations of kinship are segregated out, unquote, whereas we might think now they actually shifted hands. Darwin says in Origin, pigeons have been watched and tended with the utmost care and loved by many people for thousands of years in several quarters of the world. Peculiarly, Darwin could not have chosen a more biblical creature than the pigeon to make his points about the science of natural selection. The significance of the pigeons in linking seen and unseen worlds, spiritual and earthly realms, is strikingly similar to what anthropologists have found about bird-human relations elsewhere. Now we know that humans and rock pigeons entered into their domestic relations beginning at least 10,000 years ago, just 4,000 or so after dogs. In other words, they were the second creature to be domesticated. Treasured as food company and as the very epitome of fertility, or as we would now say, reproductive success. Perhaps because they were the only other creatures besides humans breeding year-round in the settlements of the ancient Near East, where their bones and effigies are now found together. If we took the long view, as I think Darwin did, seeing the temporal and global scope of the pigeon's intimate association with people as justifying his great analogy, then we might see Darwin and his fellow pigeon breeders as the latest in a long line of human pigeon explorations into the mysteries of life. Our studies of descent as the hidden bond of connection, to use Darwin's words, should include kin relations between humans and other animals, as well as among them, and should set the full range of these delicate relations in the context of the microenvironmental processes of which they're part. By examining how complex social relations between human and animals have been incorporated into and left out of our understanding of the entangled bank, we may understand better our past and perhaps also the relations of consanguinity.